I'm Joe Castleberry. I serve as president of Northwest University in Kirkland. And Kirkland is just 10 miles across the lake from here. So it's very close by and easy for me to get to you today. And enjoyed yesterday speaking to the Spanish-speaking ministers and in a more sermonic kind of format, which was just fun. I mean, it's great to, you know what it is. You open the Word of God, you never know what's going to happen. But it was a great, great pleasure for me to be with them, and a great pleasure today to do something different with you. And essentially, I'm going to present the seminar to you that I did at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard last year, which is at bottom a book review of my book, The New Pilgrims. And I brought along three copies, which I am going to give away in the course of the session to people who impress me. So, I grew up in Alabama during the Civil Rights Movement. I was born in 1960. In 1965, I was 5 years old. Martin Luther King Jr. came to our city three times that year, working on the Voting Rights Act and its aftermath in a very, very racist community. Demopolis, Alabama was considered one of the 10 most racist, it was in one of the 10 most racist counties in the country. The Justice Department had to send observers and officials to oversee the registration to vote, which they did at the back of the post office out of sight because it was dangerous. And it was dangerous for black people in my town to come and register to vote. So even with federal officials there and the threat of the National Guard hanging over, it was very problematic. So having grown up in a situation like that, I had the privilege of experiencing enormous change. if the change hasn't been big enough in our society, it was certainly huge in me. Because as a small child, school child in Demopolis, I was one of those activists going door to door trying to stop the integration of the schools. As a 7-year-old, I didn't really understand the dimensions. I was just doing what I was taught to do by my parents. But as our society began to change and as we began to understand the value of diversity in our society, I latched onto it fast. And wound up living in New Jersey for 20 years, and New Jersey is just immigrant central. And we had a church there that was just completely a cross-section of the world with people from everywhere. And serving as a pastor in that church, I really learned to enjoy being with immigrants and experiencing their life together. My next step was to go to El Salvador as a missionary of the Assemblies of God. That's my denomination. I'm the fourth generation in the church, so... So I went to El Salvador as a missionary and wound up spending 20 years working in Latin America as a missionary, and then came back to the United States. In 2002, I came back to the United States to become dean of the Assemblies of God Theological Seminary, and now for the last 11 years I've been at Northwest. I spend a lot of my time with immigrant communities in the United States and spend about as much time preaching in Spanish as I do in English. As a matter of fact, Spanish is ahead in the last 2 months. But it's in the about a year before the election, I was challenged to write a book on immigration. And the publisher gave me 3 months to have it ready. So I wrote this 300-page book on immigration, The New Pilgrims, and turned it in on time. But then I decided I didn't like the publisher, and I decided to stop it and look for a different publisher. So that delayed the book's coming out for a year, and it came out exactly in the month where Donald Trump came out and called Mexicans rapists and thieves and so forth. Immigration became extremely hot in the country in September of 2015, right as my book hit the shelves, and it created an enormous media opportunity for me to speak out in favor of immigrants. I wound up having 200 talk radio interviews on conservative talk radio. I was on 26 television appearances, Fox News Channel a couple of times, and have spent a lot of the last 2 years as a voice advocating for comprehensive immigration reform and a greater welcome for immigrants. So that's what I want to talk to you about today, and we'll move to application at the time of questions. So I'll try to finish with enough time to give you ample opportunity for questions. And just a quick word about Northwest before I hit it hard. Northwest is an Assemblies of God University that's about 30% AG. We have about 100 Foursquare students in our student body, and it is a remarkable place. So if you have children thinking about going to Christian University and you want them in a thoroughly Pentecostal environment, I recommend that you take a look at Northwest online and have them come visit us. Now, the New Pilgrims, How Immigrants Are Renewing America's Faith and Values. Ronald Reagan was a bit of a political hero for me. And in his last speech from the White House, his farewell speech to the American people, he said this: "I've spoken of the shining city all my political life, but I don't know if I ever communicated what I saw when I said it. In my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks, stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds, living in harmony and peace. A city with free ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here. That's how I saw it, and see it still." Of course, Reagan put his money where his mouth was, and managed to pass the last comprehensive reform of immigration in the United States, what is often called an amnesty, but legalized millions of people and improved the lives of those immigrants and also the economy and well-being in the United States with it. Since that time, politics has headed in a different direction. If you'll remember, George W. Bush was a lover of immigrants like Reagan, spoke Spanish personally. He worked very hard to achieve an immigration reform that would have solved a lot of the problems that have created the sort of crisis situation that we're seeing today. But the politics had changed sufficiently by his time that he couldn't get the legislation passed. Of course, Obama was unable to pass any legislation at all and resorted to executive orders. And as much as I was in favor of those executive orders in terms of their impact, the problem is that there are several problems with them. One is that they were illegal. there's no way around that. They were illegal. And he knew they were illegal when he passed them because he in 2011, he stated very clearly that he didn't have the authority to do this in an interview with Univision. And then when he saw that he had no ability to pass any legislation, he went ahead and did it again by executive order because he thought it was the right thing to do. And, well, now the courts are knocking it all down. So second problem with what Obama was doing is that it was sadly temporary. He didn't have the force to actually solve problems for immigrants, but rather put off the problem. So Reagan was the last president who was able to do anything useful for improving the situation of immigrants in the country. And in that language that he used, that's the shining city on a hill, he evokes something that runs very deep in the American consciousness. G.K. Chesterton, the British writer and humorist and satirist and thinker, visited America in 1927, and he wrote a book, What I Saw in America. And he said that America was a nation with the soul of a church. When he said that, he wasn't saying that America was a Christian nation. He was saying that America was a very religious nation. But he said Americans are not a religious nation because they're religious about religion. He said America was religious because it's religious about democracy. When I say in my book that immigrants are renewing America's faith and values, they are certainly renewing Christianity in America. But the argument isn't that immigrants are renewing Christianity. The argument is that immigrants are renewing America's national faith. Robert Bella called America's national faith American civil religion, a great sociologist. And American civil religion is not any specific religion, but it is the way American politicians and leaders have tended to talk about religion in public in a way that was palatable and acceptable to people from just about any religion in the world. And American civil religion has three major tenets of faith that are important to note. The first one is the Declaration of Independence. And in the Declaration of Independence, it says that we are created equal and are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among them, every American can finish that sentence. If you can't finish that sentence, you're probably not an American. I mean, that's everybody knows that, that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is a religious tenet of American identity. Americans have always believed that our rights came to us from God, not from government. And but that belief is slipping very fast in America. We are losing Christianity in America 1% per year. Over the last 30 years, we're losing about 1% of the population each year that no longer identifies as Christian. And it's certainly been that way in the last 10 years, 1% every year of people saying, nope, I'm not a Christian. That's a serious problem to America's national identity. If that keeps going for the next 30 years, you will not recognize this country. It will be a different, profoundly different country. A second thing is Winthrop's shining city on a hill. That is part of every American's belief since the beginning of the country. Winthrop was a Puritan preacher who was on his way to Massachusetts to become governor of Massachusetts in 1630. He was on board the ship Arbella, and he preached this sermon, A Shining City on a Hill. And he said that America would be like a shining city on a hill, a beacon to the rest of the world of commerce and freedom and democracy and the gospel. And that notion of America having a national mission to be a beacon to the rest of the world is a deep part of American consciousness. It goes all the way back to the Pilgrims. But that sense of national mission, that America is an exceptional nation, that God has blessed with a mission to be a light to the world, a second Israel, as it were, that belief also has been declining rapidly in recent years. A lot of Americans think that America should stop being the leader of the world, that we should stop being so involved with other countries, we should stop sending out foreign aid, we should stop doing free commerce around the world, that we should put America first and only. That's not the president's position, that is America first and only, but some people actually think of it that way. And in both left and right, on the left and the right, people are losing faith in this sense of America's national mission. Let somebody else be the world's policeman. Have you heard that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, after a decade in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've lost a lot of lives and treasure trying to promote democracy overseas. And it's understandable that people would be tired of losing that task. But nevertheless, that's been part of American consciousness from the beginning. And then the third major religious tenet of American civil religion is E Pluribus Unum. It's our national motto. It means out of many, one. And inherent in that idea of E Pluribus Unum is that to be an American doesn't imply any particular ethnic identity. And this is true of us since the very beginning. I mean, we think, in today's world, we think the difference between British and German and Swedes, we think, well, what's the difference? They're all white people, right? That was not the case in early America, where you had people coming from all over Europe and founding this new continent. They didn't see each other as the same at all. As a matter of fact, Europeans, those same white folks in Europe, had been fighting wars against each other for hundreds of years and hated each other. So America from the very beginning has been a collection of peoples from all over who found nationhood together. They became one people even though they're from many places. And to this day, you can become an American no matter where you've started. If you come here and you adopt American values and you become a citizen of this country, you're just as American as anybody who was born here. And that's true in every sense except serving as president of the United States. Only a native-born citizen can serve as president. But immigrants and their children have served in every level of high government office. As a matter of fact, secretaries of state have especially been noteworthy of being children of immigrants or immigrants themselves. And it's a country where people can come and truly become part of everything and an essential part of the national fabric. But that's also a belief that is eroding in our time. A lot of people have become xenophobic and don't believe that people from other countries should be coming here and that they should be able to come and stand on the same ground as native-born Americans. And then there are other people who think some immigrants should come but just don't want to see as many as are coming. It is fair to note that we have more immigrants in our country right now than we've ever had at any time in our history. And the percentage of Americans who were born in another country is at the highest level it's ever been. I mean, it's been flirting with that lately, but it's over that number now. So, yes, we do have a high percentage of immigrants today, but is that a problem? Well, for some people, it's a big problem because they dread the loss of America's historic ethnic majority. And they wonder whether the country can continue if the majority of Americans are not white people. It sounds awful, doesn't it? But yet, there are many who think that. Faith in America is declining. And I mean it in both senses of the words. Faith, religious faith in America is declining. That's an undeniable fact. And faith in America is declining. People no longer believe in our country the way they used to, and they don't believe in our national faith the way they used to. And it's into that context of decline that we enter the new pilgrims. Today's immigrants are overwhelmingly Christians. 68% of all legal immigrants to the country are Christians, and 83% of undocumented immigrants are Christians. In other words, an undocumented immigrant is far more likely to be a Christian than someone who isn't. Now, that bothers some Christians because they don't understand immigration law, and they think that being here as an undocumented immigrant is a crime. Well, it's not a crime under American law any more than speeding is. It's an infraction of civil law, but it's not an infraction of criminal law. And a lot of Christians, because they assume that immigration offenses are crimes, they think, how can a Christian be a criminal? How can a Christian break the law? They're easy on themselves when they break the law, but they're worried about other people's Christianity if they commit some sort of civil infraction. So Christians are coming, both legally and illegally, and they're making a huge impact on the country. Non-religious are coming also. About 20% of immigrants who come are non-religious. That matches the percent of Americans who say they're non-religious. About 4% are Muslims, and that has doubled since 2007. And it's actually going down. If we had the number right now during the Trump administration, that number would be lower. Immigration from Muslim countries is dropping under the Trump administration. So, but even so, 4% is not a huge percentage. If you live in an area that has a high concentration of Muslim immigrants, you may think they're all Muslims coming. It's not true. It's only 4% of the total. Well, I've had people get upset when I called Christian immigrants to America the new pilgrims, and because they have this hallowed sense of who the pilgrims were. But as a matter of fact, one of our national myths is a stealth myth because everybody thinks it's true. Why did the pilgrims come to Massachusetts? Can I get an answer? Religious persecution, they wanted religious freedom. That's the standard mythical answer, yes. It's also not true. Here's the situation with the pilgrims. They left England and went to Holland. They had a perfect state of religious freedom in Holland. They didn't need religious freedom. They were fine. But they didn't want their children speaking Dutch. They wanted their children to be English speakers. They wanted their children to be English in culture and identity. But they wanted religious freedom too. And the other thing is they wanted economic opportunity because they didn't have that in Holland. And the colonies represented huge potential for economic blessing, and they were Calvinist. And Calvinism sort of the original prosperity gospel. I mean, you know, prosperity was a symbol that you were one of the elect, that God's favor was on you. And so they wanted God's favor on them, and they weren't feeling it in Holland. And so they came to the colony of Virginia, which was Massachusetts, was where they landed. They're trying to get to Virginia. And they set out to try to make themselves rich, and they did become rich. And, of course, many, many, many of them died, more than half, because it was difficult. But they were willing to risk their lives in order to create a better future for themselves and their children. So that makes them a lot like the immigrants that are coming to America today. They come here. Some of them come with a sense of religious mission, but they also come for economic freedom and opportunity. You know, Franklin Roosevelt gave a speech during the Great Depression called The Four Freedoms. And in The Four Freedoms, he mentioned the four great freedoms were freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. Well, we don't have any problem with immigrants who come because they want freedom of speech. We have a special category for those kind of refugees. We don't really, we understand why someone would come for money. I mean, freedom of, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of religion, those two things we sort of favor, but that freedom from want and freedom from fear, I think people are less open to favoring people who come looking for that. But immigrants are coming because of economic motives. They're coming for opportunity. They come because they're persecuted in the place they're from. Boy, a lot are coming from Nicaragua and Venezuela right now because of the unrest in those countries that we're doing nothing to address. So they're very much like the Pilgrims of Massachusetts in that they come for economic freedom and opportunity. They also believe in America's values. Well, if you want to see something really patriotic, go to a new citizen swearing-in ceremony. You will see some of the greatest America lovers you've ever seen in your life. And they've studied up, and they know what our values are, and they've embraced them. Immigrants tend to be extremely aggressive in adopting American values. And many of their leaders are very eloquent in their expression of vision for America's future. You listen to a guy like Sammy Rodriguez, who's sort of the main voice of American Hispanic evangelicals in America. His vision for the future of America is one of the most inspiring things you'll ever hear. Immigrant leaders are eloquent advocates for America's values. Sammy Rodriguez. Like the Pilgrims that established American faith, they are renewing it. I want to speak for just a minute about the role of immigration in God's mission. This wasn't in the Harvard part, but you'll get this as an add-on for free. Immigration is a key element in God's plan for humanity. If we miss this point, we're going to fail to see the religious significance of immigration. In Genesis 1:28, God had just decided to create humanity. You remember he'd created everything. It's interesting. Genesis is not written in poetry. It's written in prose. And it's trucking along in regular prose writing for the first 27 verses. When it gets to verse 27, it breaks out into poetry because it says, "Let us make man in our own image, male and female, let us create them." It breaks out into poetry when God decides to create human beings. And this is the height of all the creation. And when God has created the human beings, he then speaks to them. And this is the first thing the Genesis records that God spoke to humanity. And the first thing he spoke to them was a blessing. This is wonderful. And what did he say? God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it." Notice the triple mandate there. Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth, and subdue it. That's a triple mandate. There's a reproduction mandate in there, have babies. There is a migration mandate, fill the earth. And there is a dominion mandate, subdue the earth and rule it. Well, you know it's going to happen. The fall is going to happen pretty soon here, and the plan of God is going to suffer a complication. When Jesus gives the Great Commission, he perfectly repeats this original human mission statement when he includes all three mandates, when he says, go into all the world, migration mandate, and preach the gospel. Make disciples of all nations. That's the reproduction mandate. And teach them to obey all that I've commanded you. That's a dominion mandate. So that the Great Commission perfectly restores the original human mission statement that God gave us. It was the first blessing he gave us was a mission. A mission to increase in number, to fill the earth, and to take dominion over it for God's glory. So that was the human mission. And what you will see from that point forward in Genesis and in the Bible is the story of human migration in the mission of God. Adam and Eve have babies. They start spreading out in obedience to the command. Sin fills the world. God saves the family of Noah. When Noah steps out of the ark, what does God say to him? Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth. He repeats the human mission statement. The next thing that happens is the Table of Nations in Genesis 10, where you see the spread of humanity out over all the world into the 70 nations that become the progenitors of humanity. And then the next statement is the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. What's the problem in Babel? No, that's not a problem.
Well, God sees it as a problem
because they're in rebellion.
Well,
yeah, well, let's step back a nudge. What is there, when they say, let us build a tower, a great city and a tower that reaches in the heavens, what is their purpose? Everybody else, they tell me that when I was a kid. The storybook said it. It must be true that they were trying to climb up into heaven, you know, trying to be like God. It says, let us build a tower, a city and a tower, so that we will make a name for ourselves and not be scattered throughout the earth. The problem is they're resisting the command of God to scatter, to fill the earth. They want to stay in one place and establish their own hegemony, their own society, their own power in that one place. It's the first empire. They want to bring all of humanity back under their administration, their government. And against what God told them to do, to scatter. And in order to keep them from accomplishing their task, in order to keep them from succeeding in their rebellion, he confuses their languages, creating a burst of diversity. Now, a lot of people don't understand that diversity, human diversity, is God's plan from the beginning. That's why he wanted us to fill the earth and spread out and multiply, because distance creates diversity. Distance creates new cultures and new languages. And it's amazing if you go from place to place within a country, how the language is spoken differently from place to place across it. That confusion of the languages would have happened no matter what. Languages would have diversified. But God speeds it up at Babel as a sign of grace to us. So at any rate, that's too long to talk about. But from there, the next chapter is Abraham. And what is Abraham? What's the story with Abraham? God says to him, leave your father and mother and go to the place I will show you. It takes two generations for Abraham to get from where he started to where he winds up in Canaan. But the rest of the story from there is the story of the migration of Abraham's children. There's so much you could read. You could read the book, and you could read my blogs about my Bible blog about the immigration in the Bible. But just immigration story after immigration story throughout the book of Genesis, it winds up with Joseph become. You know, you've got the first human trafficking case, which is Hagar, who's a slave from Egypt and forced into sexual service in Abraham's household. She's then cast out of there. You've got labor slavery. You got Joseph, the first labor slave that the Bible mentions, who's for labor is sent off to a different country. And of course, he saves Egypt. And then after that, you have the Exodus from Egypt. You've got God's people migrating to the Promised Land. They're only there about 400 years, and they get sent into captivity in Babylon. Then they migrate back to Israel. But in the meantime, Jews have spread out all over the world. And then the diaspora of the Jews completely fills the world just in time for the New Testament. Jews have scattered to all the major cities in the Roman Empire just in time for the gospel to come, when Jesus, the great migrant, makes the biggest trek ever from heaven to earth. As a baby, is sent into Egypt as a refugee, comes back to Israel, and then tells his disciples to go into all the world and preach the gospel, giving us the Great Commission. And the rest of the New Testament from that point forward is Book of Acts, where they spread out to all of the world. And then the letters that they write to those communities all over the world where the gospel is spreading for the rest of the New Testament. The Bible is the story of God's mission being fulfilled by migrants. And immigration is a crucial part of how God does His work in the world, and it's what God is doing right now in the United States. The history of Christianity in the United States is a cycle of decline and renewal, with immigrants being used by God over and over again to revitalize the church. Virtually every denomination in America was founded by a new wave of immigrants coming in. There wouldn't be any Lutheran churches in America if it weren't for German and Scandinavians coming here as immigrants. Matter of fact, that's why you really have different denominations in America, is because different ethnic groups came with different religious colors and shapes. And if you look at the history of Great Awakenings in America, there's a whole chapter in my book about this. If you look at the history of the Great Awakenings, immigrants were key to every one of the Great Awakenings and major revivals that have ever occurred in America. Immigrants are one of the ways God shakes us up and puts our attention back on Him. Well, as I said, immigrants are renewing America's faith and values. I want to quickly summarize some of the ways they're doing that. First, immigrants are renewing the American population. Our birth rate in America, our total fertility rate, is the lowest we've ever seen. It just was measured at 1.7. The only reason it's higher than 1 is two things. Secular Americans have one baby or less per family. And they're about 50% of the population if you count mainline Protestants as secular folks. About half the population. About half the population is evangelicals and immigrants. Immigrants are overwhelmingly Christians. While the secularists are having one baby per family, causing the national population to be cut in half in one generation, if that's the only people there were. Immigrants are having 3 babies per family. Well, the average is 2.9. And evangelicals are having 3 babies per family. What does that tell you about the future of the American population? It tells you that Christianity is fixing to have a major comeback because secular folks are not reproducing themselves. Christians are reproducing themselves 3 to 1, 3 to 1 over secular people. We're going to have a great awakening in the next generation. It's going to happen. I mean, the society itself is going to move towards religion because the society is going to become significantly more religious in the next generation than it is in this one. And I'll tell you, the cavalry is coming just in time, because if you look at the religiousness of young people in America today, it's getting weaker and weaker and weaker. Immigrants truly are the cavalry coming to save us. Catholics, it's interesting, 70% of all new Catholics in America are Latinos. 70%. The Catholic Church, without Latinos, would have been decimated in our time. It's really become a Latino church. And that doesn't even count. That 70% doesn't count Filipinos and Catholics that come from all over, from Africa and the rest of the world. There's a whole lot of immigrant Catholics, and they're keeping the Catholic Church alive. Immigrants are also renewing churches. Immigrants are planting the majority of new churches in virtually every Christian denomination, as well as planting mosques and temples and houses of worship from other religions. But again, those numbers are very small compared to the number of Christians that are coming. It's impressive. I did a study of denomination after denomination to see what immigrants were doing in them. And virtually all the new churches outside of the evangelical world are being planted by immigrants. But in the evangelical world, it's still overwhelmingly the majority of churches are being planted by immigrants. One of the funny things that you'll notice is that you'll have immigrants planting churches in mainline Protestant denominations, and they are very conservative and often Pentecostal. But because they've gotten an opportunity from the Congregationalist Church, from the Church, you know, from the Churches of, United Churches of Christ Church, or other mainline denomination, because they've helped them and give them a building to plant a church in and allowed them to do it, they are part of that denomination. And there's no growth edge to any Protestant, mainline Protestant religion. They're all declining. But the only growth they're seeing is in these immigrant populations. It's funny, those immigrant churches that meet in the afternoon in those churches sometimes will have a demon clearing session to kind of scare off all the demons that had been there in the earlier service. But nevertheless, they appreciate the building and the help. It's that's supposed to be funny, but it's not funny. It's tragic, but nevertheless, it's the truth. Even the mainline churches are seeing significant influx of immigrants that are saving their bacon. And in the Assemblies of God, which is my church, we are now 51% white and 49% people of color. This is from one of the hallmark most white denominations in the world back in, say, 1980. And the reason that happened was that we adopted a national strategy for helping immigrants plant churches. And that strategy was exactly what we were doing overseas, which is get out of their way and let them work. You know, empower them, give them dignity, let them govern themselves, let them propagate themselves, let them finance themselves, get out of their way and let them work and give them credit for what they're doing. And we've had this massive explosion of immigrant churches, as Foursquare is having as well. The Assemblies is sort of the paradigm of American evangelicalism in terms of ethnic growth. Southern Baptists are having unbelievable ethnic growth as well, even as the denomination is losing members every year. And boy, with this recent scandal, they're going to struggle even more next year. But immigrants are saving the Southern Baptists from rapid decline. And especially in the Latino populations, but not just that. Koreans and Chinese and people from all over the world are planting new Baptist churches, with Southern Baptist churches that are bringing a brand new day. We expect the Assemblies of God will be majority-minority next year. And there's no arresting that. Nobody would want to arrest it. This is what God is doing. We're growing the way the country's growing, so that's good. I know the Foursquare is having the same kind of experience. Immigrant churches have always been the solution to the phenomenon that Durkheim, the sociologist, calls anomie. When people are uprooted from everything they've ever known and from the value systems they've been raised in, they've been separated from the people they grew up with, and nobody cares about them, and there's nobody around that cares what they do, they will often drift into criminal behavior. This is the story of immigrant crime gangs from the very beginning in the United States. Every immigrant group that has ever come to America has had a problem with immigrant crime gangs. When I was a kid, it was the West Side Story in New York City and the Puerto Rican gangs and Nicky Cruz and all that, right? Now it's the Mara Salvatrucha. It's the Russian mob. It's all kinds of immigrant gangs. This happens because many immigrants, when they come to a new place, it doesn't have to be America, they lose track of their moral grounding. what the immigrant church does, I mean, at the same time that some immigrants are getting in trouble in the new place, other immigrants, the first thing they do is start a church. And they reach out to those that are losing their way. The churches that I surveyed were sowing 50 to 80% of their members were new converts. 30% of all Latino immigrants who come to the United States are becoming Pentecostal, according to Time Magazine. It's unbelievable the revival that's happening in immigrant churches as immigrants reach out to immigrants and who know they need to get saved because their life is falling apart. And boy, America needs immigrant churches to help us with the problem of enemy among immigrants because, you know, the Mara Salvatrucha is real and it's very dangerous. Today's immigrant churches are winning converts and they're reaching native-born Americans too. And their young leaders are joining dominant culture churches. It's amazing how many major leaders in our church now in the English-speaking churches are children of immigrants. It's been true. It's funny, if you look back into Symbols of God history in the past, the big names were Russian names, German names, and Italian names. The number of superintendents who were children of immigrants was very high. It's always been the case in Assemblies of God. Now it's Latino names that are taking major positions of leadership in the church because the children of immigrants make great leaders. You know why that is? In white churches in America, children are treated as children, and they're not considered to be adults really until they're 28. Yeah. They're not expected to get married or start their careers or get their own health insurance. Or, you know, of course, they couldn't plant a church at 21, 24. You know, they're treated like they were children because that is the larger phenomenon in white culture, and it's infected our churches too. In immigrant churches, a 12-year-old is a Sunday school teacher. You know, a 12-year-old can run the children's ministry. You know, a 12-year-old can be on the worship band. And what we see in immigrant churches everywhere is that they take these kids when they're teenagers and they put them to work doing real things, doing adult-level things. Hi, Israel. Gusto verte. It's true. So let's take Israel as a study. Israel grows up in a Pentecostal church where he's expected to do everything. And he's treated like an adult from the time he's a young teenager. When he gets to college, his level of leadership experience is way above the other students. And so he instantly becomes a leader at Northwest, instantly. And this isn't just Israel. It's the majority of our Latino kids and other immigrant kids. I mean, lately all the student body presidents are either foreign students or children of immigrants. They rise to leadership very fast because they're used to being leaders. And that isn't just affecting the native-born church. It's affecting the native-born society because the same skills that they're learning at church, they take over into their secular activity as well. They make great leaders, and they always have. None of this is new. This is just America being America. Immigrants are also renewing America's community and family values. American culture breeds individualists from the beginning. That's the way our culture is created. And for a couple of hundred years, Americans have taken inspiration from the families of immigrants. They work together. They contribute to the well-being of the house. They want to be together. They respect their parents. They have the most beautiful, inspiring families. It was really interesting. My daughter Jody was born in El Salvador and speaks Spanish, of course. And she fell in love with a movie star, handsome Latino guy from Northwest, Robert Valdez. And boy, this guy's so good looking. I tell you, Jody's a walking fashion model herself. They're a beautiful couple. So they got married and we had the wedding and we had a double preacher wedding. You know, I did half of it and the Hispanic pastor did half of it and it was a beautiful wedding. So when we took wedding pictures, they took pictures of the Castleberry family and we were 12 people, including my family of five, a couple of relatives that had come and a few missionaries that we considered family. And so we were 12 when I took our picture. the Valdez clan had 100 people there. And they had the cuñado and the suegra and everybody. I mean, they had they had names of relatives that we don't even have names for. And that about 30% of immigrant kids are going to marry native-born Americans. They marry somebody from outside their ethnic group. And that has been happening since the very beginning of America, because immigrants tend to be very ambitious and they tend to work hard. And and about 30% of immigrants are what we call assimilators. I mean, they're looking to assimilate as fast as they can and become full-fledged Americans in every way. And they will often marry a native-born American. It renews American families. It's been doing it since the beginning, and it's doing it now, and it's a beautiful thing. But it isn't just families. It's community values themselves. Have you been to a Rotary Club lately? Go to the Rotary Club, and you will see lots of immigrants coming to Rotary Club. It's a service club. It's a communitarian club because they love that. Thanks for proving my point. So it's funny. I had a couple of Ecuadorian visitors this weekend, and we were down at the waterfront in Kirkland. And I said, look around and see who's here. And they looked around, and they said, well, it's all people from all over the place. I said, yeah. On holidays, it was Sunday night before Memorial Day. I said, on holidays in America, Americans seek the privacy of their own backyard. They want to be with their four and no more, maybe some friends that they've invited over, but they certainly don't want to be out in the public because they're individualist. Immigrants, on a holiday, they go downtown. They go looking for the community. They want to be with other people. And it's so funny. On any Saturday, Sunday, or holiday in the Kirkland waterfront down at the marina, it's just a United Nations of people. Of immigrants seeking out the community, who can they meet, it's a powerful thread that sews the fabric of American society back together. Immigrants are also renewing our educational system. I'm going to go really fast here so we can have some questions. The majority of students in elementary and high school in the United States this year are non-white. It's the first time in history. Last year was the first time in history that the majority of students in American schools were non-white. This year, or it was actually last year, Latino high school graduates attended university at a higher rate than white students, who traditionally had much higher rates of attendance. When I was doing my doctoral program in higher education, 67% of white kids were going to college within 4 years of graduating from high school. Only 50% of Latinos were going. And there was all this explanation in there about how Latino culture doesn't value education, doesn't like reading, and it's all these explanations for why Latino kids don't go to college if they somehow graduate from high school, which is the way it was back then. Boy, that's over. We still struggle with the high school graduation rate among Latino immigrants, but Latino kids have figured out that the key to success in America is going to college. And if they get through high school, they're going to college. It's about 67% now. White numbers have dropped a little bit. But they're planning to take over. And God bless them. We need them. So not only that, immigrants are renewing America's politics. Immigrants care about two things politically. The two major values of immigrants is that they want economic opportunity and they want justice. It just so happens in America we have two parties, one of which prides itself on being the party of economic opportunity, and the other that prides itself on being the party of political justice. Which party are the immigrants going to choose? Well, one party has a huge advantage in that it bills itself as the party of family values, economic opportunity, its conservative values, and turns out that immigrants overwhelmingly are pretty conservative in their social values. That party, if it decides that it wants to reach out to immigrants and win them as voters, has a golden opportunity to win them. Unfortunately, that party right now is speaking against them loudest. It's what we call electoral stupidity. The other party is at least talking like they care about them. One of my favorite writers on immigration is a guy named Ruben Navarrete. He's a columnist for the Dallas News, I think, but it has a syndicated column all over the country. Brilliant guy, Mexican-American, Harvard grad. He just wrote a column recently just excoriating the Democrats for throwing away the opportunity to legalize the DACA recipients, and they did. The Democrats are playing politics with this issue just as badly as the Republicans are. One of these days, very soon, the parties are going to figure this out. And electoral math is going to solve a lot of the problems we're seeing right now. I'm not optimistic about immigration reform in the next year. I've been working really hard on this issue. I spend a lot of my time on this issue, and I've talked to a lot of congresspeople about it. We've got a group here in the area called the Common Sense Coalition that is a group of Republicans and Democrats have put together a compromise proposal on immigration. We've been shopping it to legislators and just making as much noise as we can to get some attention. But I don't think we're going to make any progress before the midterms. But eventually, the numbers are going to solve this problem. And it's going to transform American politics. You know, we started this out with a quote from Ronald Reagan, and we noted how much the Republican Party has changed on immigration since Reagan. I can tell you, both parties are going to change again. They're always shifting. No, political parties don't care about ideas. They care about power. And so the situation will determine which values they proclaim and which ideas they foster. Immigrants are going to have their day in the sun politically in America. Finally, immigrants are renewing America's economy. According to CNN Money, 50%, they are 50% more likely to start new businesses in America and employ other people. Immigrants create 1.2 jobs for every one job they take. And they create jobs for native-born Americans. It's not just that they're coming here and only creating jobs for immigrants. I got a real kick out of it. I went to a Mexican restaurant in Jasper, Alabama. I'm from Alabama. I went there to visit my uncle. And there's a Mexican restaurant there in Jasper. And it's a restaurant owned by a Mexican family who has probably 20, 25 restaurants in the Southeast. And I went in there, sat down with my uncle to have some good Mexican food. And all the waiters were white people. It turned out I was the only person in the building who could speak Spanish. Well, when you're seeing that in Jasper, Alabama, which is a pretty small town, it's pretty good evidence that immigrants are employing white people. A large number, about 28% of new firms in America are founded by immigrants. 28% of 17% of the population is foreign-born. 28% of new businesses are founded by immigrants. Why are they founding new businesses? Because they don't have a stake. They've got to build. This is how they build opportunities, by building their own new businesses. And about 28% of all Main Street businesses in America are immigrant founded, which means that they're restoring America's cities and small towns. Large number of leading high-tech entrepreneurs and executives are immigrants, including the founder of Google and many other large technology companies in the country. You know, whether it's Google or your local taco stand, it's a very good probability that an immigrant has founded it. And a thing that has not been talked about much in the media is that immigrants not only help in the supply side, and that is bringing products to market, they also create a lot of demand and consumer action on the other side. Had it not been for 60 million new immigrants that came to America in the last 50 years with their children, we may have spun into an economic depression in this last recession. 50% of all economic growth is population growth. Without the immigrants, we would have had population decline. We would not have had a growing economy. We would have had a weakening economy over these years. And if the Great Recession had turned into the Great Depression instead, it would have wrecked the world economy. It's very possible that by coming to America, legally or not, immigrants in the last 50 years actually saved the world from collapse. It's a terrible thing. America has aborted 60 million babies in the last 50 years. 60 million abortions. just so happens that about 60 million immigrants and their children have come to the United States. It's an interesting replacement. In summary, if you love God and you love America, you ought to love immigrants. God has sent us this massive wave, this impressive wave of immigrant missionaries to give us another chance in this country because God loves America and God still has a purpose for us. If we hadn't had this round of immigrants, I wouldn't have so much confidence. But these immigrants to me, these 70% Christian immigrants, they're evidence that God loves us. Canada has only about 30% Christian immigrants. Europe, even less. Man, we ought to get down on our knees every day and thank God for the immigrants He's sending us. Because in them is the seed of our national renewal. Well, I'll end with Reagan's final quote in that speech. He said, "And how stands the city on this winter night? She's still a beacon, still a magnet for all who must have freedom, for all the pilgrims from all the lost places who are hurtling through the darkness toward home." Reagan saw them as pilgrims. And I say, may the beacon keep shining in our time as well, signaling to all of the new pilgrims, welcome home. And now we'll take time for questions. We have 10 minutes. Apologize for going over. You're going to help me with the microphone? First one to ask me a good question is going to get a book. Yeah. Any question's a good question. The question can't be, can I have the book? No. It was not repulsive. It was okay. Yeah.
On the topic you're talking about, how do you see the American church's responsibility?
Yeah, of course you do. We got this thing, got it started. Your turn.
I try to get my thoughts together to say this. Should the American church see themselves as first Christians or see themselves as Americans who are Christians?
Well, you know the answer to that. I would rather obey God than man. Christians, no value can outweigh the kingdom for us. That doesn't mean that we have to become scofflaws or opposed to American law. Hey, you know, let me say something controversial. I'm for the border wall. I think it would be a great idea because we've got serious disorder down there that's hurting everybody. It's hurting Mexico. It's hurting us. We could restore some order on the Mexican border. That would be good for everybody. The whole situation of human trafficking down there and the work of the coyotes, I mean, they're charging immigrants $10,000, $20,000 to smuggle them across the border, and they're not protecting them, and they're exposing them to tremendous danger. Kids are being trafficked. It's a terrible – drugs, of course. It's a terrible situation. I'm for the rule of law. One of the reasons I advocate so strongly for a comprehensive review of our laws and a comprehensive reform of them is that we are endangering the rule of law in America. The thing that makes us what we are is the rule of law. If it wasn't for the rule of law in America, immigrants wouldn't come here. They want to come and have the protection of the law, and they want to have a just society. If we lose that, we won't be getting wonderful immigrants in the future. We'll be in a mess. So we need to restore the rule of law. And the only way we're going to be able to restore the rule of law is to reform the law, because the laws that are on the books right now don't work. They don't work for immigrants, and they don't work for us. So let's change the law, fix it, and then regularize the situation of the people who've come here during a period when we ourselves were not good stewards of the law. Yeah, this is for you. Wait, let's get you the microphone.
So, one of the striking things about this, thank you, this was really informative, is that it was informative. I think a lot of the stats and the perspective that you have is lost on a lot of church members because we don't understand the bigger picture of immigrants and kind of zooming out of our own, you know, personal beliefs and our own personal perspectives to kind of look at the bigger picture and see where God is in that. How do you recommend, or what resources would you recommend for churches to equip themselves and educate themselves on this information so that we don't go off on opinion or off of, you know, whatever TV person we agree with and
right.
kind of look at it from facts and go from there.
You know, there are a lot of excellent resources out there. There's a book called Welcoming the Stranger by Matthew Sorens. That's an excellent book. Excellent book, Welcoming the Stranger. My book is a comprehensive argument. You didn't get half of it. You know, 300 pages of detailed argument here, especially on this issue of the rule of law, which is really crucial to understand. There are a lot of great books on the market about multi-ethnic churches and that sort of thing. But what I was saying earlier about the Assemblies of God strategy, I strongly recommend to you, get out of the immigrant's way. Enable them. Don't create dependency. Let them give them dignity and a place to work, and they'll reach the immigrants, and they'll be a lot more effective at it than native-born Americans who don't speak their language well and don't understand their culture. But let's empower people and give them opportunity to plant the church. And within a generation or two, it will fully have come home to help us as a whole. And also have a lot of positive benefits with the immigrant communities. Partnership for a New American Economy is really good on their website. Provides a tremendous amount of good information about immigrants, about immigration, and countering the argument of groups like CIS, the Center for Immigration Studies. And if you go to their website, Center for Immigration Studies, you'll see the harshest arguments from the other side, but in a sort of a scholarly venue, so that it's masked with scholarship, but it's also, you can see the twist. I mean, they take the information, they twist it to give it a political edge. Now, look, I'm not saying I'm unpolitical, but you know, there is such a thing as truth out there, and we got to have people if we're going to have a future. We're not having them ourselves. Chasing 15 million people out of the country who've established themselves here and learning English, buying houses, running businesses. I know a family of undocumented immigrants in Tacoma that owns 3 Mexican restaurants and a beautiful home, have become millionaires here in the United States, and they still can't get a visa. This is just insanity. Yeah. So, and there's no serious talk of mass deportation in America. Nobody's going to do it. Donald Trump's certainly not going to do it. He's too smart to do something stupid like that. Yep.
Well, I'm sorry for my English. I'm a speaker as an immigrant here. She say a question, hard to understand. That's the one thing is. The society plant poison in another communities. When I came to the United States, I started working with the gangs in those days, 70s. And I was hired for Camper Crusade, well, I'm an assembly guy too, and then Foursquare. And we went to the South Central LA, reconciliation, Hispanics with blacks. And one of my supervisors from Campus Crusade was a white guy. And he asked me, can you go with me to South Central? And we start talking with the blacks. And we find so many things, poison, like Hispanics take over the jobs, take over this, take over that. So that create a war between blacks and Hispanics. Thank God we worked hardly in the 70s and 80s, and we start getting together, put Hispanics and black churches, and we, you know, we still see today churches, Hispanic, worshiping in black communities, and that was one of those great things happened with us. You know, I'm still working with Hispanics and blacks, and now I have my company. I have blacks working for me, and we're doing great things.
Great.
So glory to God.
Our time is up, so we'll formally end the session, but we did have one more question, so let's take it. Yep.
First, thank you so much for your information. It was awesome and great perspectives. I learned a lot. But how do you assimilate the different cultures, the immigrants, into a church without creating a church within a church?
Why wouldn't you want to do that?
What's that?
Why not create a church within a church?
Because then you're creating, in my estimation, you're creating, now you're separating everybody out instead of being one church as a whole. You have this community, this community, this community.
Right. And here, I think the answer to that is don't frustrate yourself trying to do things that aren't necessary. And here's what I'm going to say. What I want to say about that is that about 30% of immigrants are assimilators. They want to learn English fast. They want to join the English-speaking church. That's what they want to do. Let them. That's great. But to create a Spanish-speaking or Korean-speaking or Chinese-speaking church inside your church is going to reach those 70% of immigrants that are not so fluid in assimilating to the new culture and are not going to. And so, I mean, the first generation of immigrants, by and large, never really masters the language so that they want to worship in it. It just, you're asking them to go much faster than you would go if you were in their country. I don't know if you're probably an assimilator, but nevertheless, it's why frustrate yourself trying to stop something from happening that really needs to happen? And they're far more effective at reaching new immigrants in their own language than the English-speaking church is ever going to be. So do both. Do both things. Make it very welcoming. Give them opportunity. Provide ministries to their children. But give them as much autonomy. I spend a lot of time. And matter of fact, for that great question, you get the third book. You want to give them as much autonomy as you possibly can.
Right.
You want to give it. I think we're not recording that, right?
No.
Give them as much autonomy as you possibly can. Because with autonomy comes dignity. And dignity is what they really need. It's very undignified. You come in as a brand new immigrant, you don't speak the language, and you're disempowered, and it's scary. I mean, you should never underestimate how scary it is for people to come and reestablish themselves in a new place and don't speak the language and don't understand what's going on. Language isn't even the biggest thing. The cultural difference is a big thing. So expect them to have to be to adopt to our culture first before they can worship. It's just too big of a hurdle. So you want to get rid of barriers. And I say one of the reasons the Assemblies of God has been so incredibly successful at this is that they haven't tried to force everybody into one group together. We've created all kinds of ethnic fellowships where they can be presbyters and superintendents and have positions and have titles and have authority and have dignity. And it's caused them to just explode in growth. So the other will happen. Just don't be too quick. And be patient. People will come to you. Your church will grow larger with people from all over. And you'll have Latinos and Ukrainians coming and marrying each other in your English-speaking church. it'll be beautiful. You'll have that multi-ethnic church you want, but don't go too quickly to it. Create the environment where people are welcome and loved and served. And the ones, some will gravitate to you and others will gravitate to them. Ethic our nation. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much. I'm honored that you came to my session. I hope you enjoyed it. And if I can help you, please let me know. I've got it hard here. If you'd like that. Hard to stand.